Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Business Over Breakfast. My name is Shelley Heshin. I'm the Manager of Incubation and Entrepreneur Programs here at InnovaCorp. Welcome. We've got a great topic this morning, intellectual property, potential issues. I'll introduce our speakers. So right here, we've got Cecile Klein-Gibbelwave. Cecile is the Business Development Officer with the Canadian Intellectual Property Office, and she's been with them for 17 years. So she has probably heard and seen probably any type of issue that there's been. She's very experienced in Canadian, U.S., and European patent databases. Prior to her work at CIPO, Cecile was Business Development Officer with Industry Canada. She was also a Complaints Officer with the Competition Bureau. And Cecile's office is actually located in this building, just down the hall. So welcome, Cecile. Next, I'd like to introduce Stuart Hain. Stuart is a partner with Cox & Palmer. He's a registered Canadian patent agent and a registered Canadian trademark agent. His litigation practice includes contract, joint venture, fiduciary duty, confidentiality, IP licensing, patent, trademark, software, copyright, trade secrets, and trade dress disputes. So he's appeared before the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia, the Federal Court, and the Federal Court of Appeal. Stuart got his law degree from Dalhousie University. He's practiced IP litigation in Toronto and Vancouver before moving back to Halifax and joining Cox & Palmer. So welcome, Stuart.
Thank you.
So the format for this morning, Cecile is going to give us an overview on the different kinds of intellectual property. And then after that, Stuart is going to talk a little bit about the lifeline of IP, and then we'll open it up to question and answer. So Cecile will go first, and then I'll get you to hold your questions to the Q&A. So write down your questions. So welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me at the back? Am I speaking loud enough? Yep? Okay, good. Well, thank you, Shelley. It's a pleasure for me to speak to you this morning, and I've been here at InnovaCorp Enterprise Center since December the 3rd, and I really enjoy the location and the people around me. My territory is Atlantic Canada, so I do get to travel quite a bit, and I've been with the government for over 30 years, and this is the subject matter that I've enjoyed the most since I've been working. So what's in it for you? Well, intellectual property is a property, as most of you know, and it can be the most important property that you have. So the objective that I do with this presentation is just to go over the various forms to help you recognize what the benefits are, learn how to protect it, and discover how many resources are out there. There's so much information that is free for everyone to take a look at so that you can be well prepared, so that you can develop a good strategy before moving forward with whatever innovation you're involved in. So it can be the most valuable asset that you have, because that's what it is. It's like owning a car, or owning products, or owning a house, or chairs and tables. But it's one that can open many doors, both provincially, nationally, internationally, if it's done in the correct way. And it can also help you avoid very costly mistakes. And there's some very good examples of costly mistakes out there. That's because they just didn't do their due diligence or their homework, or decided not to do anything about it. So the information that's available now, you can actually identify trends. If you look at the patent databases that are available to anyone, you can actually see what's been happening, for example, in the communication industry. You can follow the different types of phones that are coming out, your iPhones that are coming out. Well, if you want to know the next one that Apple is going to be putting out on the market, I can almost guarantee you that it's in the pending U.S. patent database, waiting for it to be issued. And I can guarantee you that when the patents issue, which is every Tuesday the databases are put up to date, you can see that what's going on in that world of invention, and those big companies are all looking to see what everybody else is doing. identify key contacts. If you're having a hard time finding a distributor or finding somebody to enter into a licensing agreement with, well, the databases may tell you this, because not only does it give you the name of the inventor, it also gives you the name of the manufacturer, if it's assigned to a manufacturer, potentially someone who's going to be interested in what you're doing. Some solutions to problems, and of course you want to prevent infringement and you don't want to waste your money and your time. So go take a look to see what is out there already. So these are the topics that I'm going to talk about, and I only have 20 minutes. I'm going to do it really quick, but if there's questions after, please don't hesitate to ask. So I'm going to start with trade secrets. This trade secrets, usually it's an organization kind of forget what they have that can actually be of value, because every business has one form or another of trade secrets. It could be your strategy that you're developing. You don't want the competitor to know what your strategy is. It could be a formula. Or it could be specific product information. It could be the way of pricing something. And it's extremely important to let your employees know that they are bound by this confidential information. Maybe even having an employee contract with a clause in it that states in it that what they create while they're employed by you belongs to your organization. I was just talking to someone the other day who was involved in the security industry, and they had an employee that left, had signed a non-disclosure employee contract, and went to try to solicit business trying to create his own by going after the clients, or the client called the original company. So you have to be very careful, because not only what it can do, even though you can go after them, it can really cause a significant devaluation of what you're doing, because that's no longer, it no longer holds the value that it used to hold. So it could be a recipe. Colonel Sanders' secret recipe, the Lebanese and spices, for example, that's a famous one that's protected. Two companies make it. One company makes half the recipe, another company makes the other half. So only a handful of people know. So very, very important to be aware of it and to think about what you're doing in your own business to see what can be protected through trade secrets. And the beauty of trade secrets, it can last forever, as long as the secret is not disclosed. And it is a form of IP. It can be licensed, it can be assigned, it can be sold, and they're protected through non-disclosure confidentiality agreement. Not everything can be protected, however, through trade secrets. For example, if you have a widget, if you can reverse engineer it, then engineering, then that is not your best type of protection. So, move on to patents. What is the deal? Well, if you fully disclose to the patent office what your invention is, so completely disclose it, what the patent office will do, if you meet the criteria, will issue you the exclusive rights for 20 years from the date of filing. Patents are territorial. By that I mean it's up to the inventor to decide when and where they want to file, because you will only have protection where you file. So if you file in North America, then nobody else in the rest of the entire world can file for the same thing you file for, but they can make it and sell it where you don't file. Canada is part of several treaties and conventions, and there's also something called PCT, Patent Co-op Treaty. If you have more questions about that, we can go through it later, but because of time, we're just going to move on. So what is patentable? It could be a product. It could be a composition. Any type of recipe or formula. It can be a machine. It can be a process. Or there are improvements. 90% of the patents that are issued today are improvements on existing technology. And what the patent office looks for are three things. Novelty, utility, and ingenuity. Novelty means that your invention has been new to the entire world, not just to Canada, but to the whole world. Utility means it has to work, and not only to work, but it has to be useful. And ingenuity means it either has to be brand new or an improvement. If it's an improvement, the improvement cannot be obvious to somebody of average skill in the art or in that field of invention. So before filing, this is where anybody who's dealing into any type of innovation should be thinking IP. Should be thinking first, what do I do first? I have an idea, intellectual property should be the next thing that comes to mind. Because if it's an afterthought, then usually it's too late. So, because if you've got the widget out on the market and you think, oh boy, I wonder if that's patentable. Well, probably it isn't by that time. So the minute that you start thinking of something, the first step should be going into those databases to see what has been issued in your field of invention. And keep it confidential. very, very crucial that you keep your innovations and inventions confidential prior to disclosing. Because if you do not do that, then you are jeopardizing the commercial value that you're creating. Because there's only three countries that will accept an application upon disclosure: Canada, U.S., and Korea. I believe, and to the rest of the world, it doesn't pass the novelty test. So anyone that you have, if you say, well, I have to hire an engineer and an electrician, get them to sign a non-disclosure agreement. That's the way to solve that problem. Search the databases, search the literature, and that's where I come into play. If you need help in doing it and searching, I don't do searches for people, but I can show you how to do it. It'd be my pleasure to do so. And then the patent application, consult. Once you've done your homework, you've done all the research, then consult the sealed hands of the world. Go to the registered patent agent. These folks can draft and file for you, can request it, can do everything that needs to be done for your patent application. Trademarks. Now, to me, trademarks is one of a company's most valuable assets. Yes, patents are important. You have to protect your innovation and trade secrets, but your trademark, what is it? It can be a word. It can be a combination of more than one word. It can be a logo. It can be a slogan. Zoom, zoom. Everybody knows that one from Mazda. It can be a shape, which is called a distinguishing guise. What a trademark does, it distinguishes your products and services apart from everybody else in the marketplace. So, in other words, anybody can sell bottled water, but they can't call it Dasani. And there's a difference between a business name and a trademark. A business name is the name you carry yourself under, and the trademark is associated with the product or with the service. If your trademark can be part of your business name, even better. Because then when you file an application and it becomes registered, you want it nationally. And it's the only IP that's renewable. So in other words, you can own it forever. And the value, I heard this underneath the other day, the makers of Spam, Hormel, they bought Skippy peanut butter from Unilever for $700 million. I thought I heard it wrong, but I didn't. Because they figure that they're going to make that and much more in the next few years, because Skippy, which is the brand that they're buying, and probably the trade secret, is the number one selling peanut butter in China. So the value of the brand, for the cost that for what it costs for you to file an application to register your trademark, your best investment, I can tell you, guarantee it. So something to very much take a look at. So common law rights, yes, there's no law that says you have to register your trademark. The minute you start using one, you start obtaining proprietary rights to it under common law. Best interest for you to file, because upon registration, and once it becomes registered, you own it for 15 years and renewable thereafter, as long as you keep using it. And use it or lose it, absolutely. If you have a registered trademark and the trademark office becomes aware that you're not using it and you can't prove that you are, you can actually use it. And avoid generic use, because if it comes in a common language, then it's no longer registrable. And licensing it to others, that's how it becomes so valuable. If you want a franchise, you need a registered trademark, because you can't license something you don't own. And of course, promptly stop unlicensed use. If you know somebody somewhere in the country is using your trademark, let them know, because it's your property, and there's nothing at all stopping you from sending them a letter to cease and desist. Copyright. What is that? Well, our office, the Canadian Intellectual Property Office, really we have nothing to do with the legislation, but we are the copyright register, which means we will gladly accept your money and your filing fee and send you a registration certificate that will prove that it belongs to you. So it's burden of proof. So what does it protect? It protects works, literary, artistic, musical, and dramatic works. So, and copyright is just that. It is the right to reproduce something. And only the owner has the right to reproduce something. Owner, author, not necessarily the same creature. Because I create copyright subject matter, we all do. We type, we send text, we create emails, we PowerPoint presentations, that all falls under copyright. But me, I am an employee of the federal government, so I am the author, but I don't own anything. So all of you in your organizations, you have employees yourselves and so on that create things. It's important for them to know that what they create stays within the copyright belongs to the business. So protect literary, dramatic, musical, and artistic works. Now, it's automatic. When I first started working for CITO 17 years ago, and my then boss said, this one's automatic, I said, oh, great, when that's easy. I was so wrong. Copyright is the most complex of all the other IP that exists. It's automatic. How do you prove that it belongs to you? So it's not an easy law. And the marking, the C in the circle, I'm sure you've seen that. That's the international symbol for copyright. So you should see it everywhere on whatever you create. Your brochures, your websites have copyright in it. Anything that has copyright subject matter, this should appear. And you do not need to have your work registered to use this symbol. You can put it on your grocery list. It's a literary work. Or put on your kids' drawings. And generally, how long does copyright exist? Generally, it's life of the author, not the owner, life of the author, plus 50 years after the last remaining author dies. And what you have, Canadian copyright will be recognized by most industrialized countries of the world. What you have to be careful is that the domestic laws of other countries you're going to. For example, in the U.S., how long copyright will exist generally 75 years instead of 50. Life of the author for 75, and it's all because of Mickey Mouse. True, Mickey Mouse is about ready to turn 50. But Disney lobbied the government to change it to 75, and they won. The power of Disney. Okay. Industrial design. What does that protect? Industrial design, that is interesting. What it protects? It protects the aesthetics of an object, shape and ornamentation. So, for example, the shape of this bottle will be protected by an industrial design. So, and the beauty, and as you see here, the shape of the heels of the sneakers, faucets, doorknobs, for example, furniture. So, the shape of things. And that's made out by either by hand or by tool. And there is a shelf life to this as well. You have to keep it confidential. You have the exclusive rights for 5 years, which you can renew for another 5. So for 10 years, you'll have the exclusive rights on the shape. But the beauty of a trade of a industrial design is if the shape of your product becomes known in the marketplace by its shape, for example, a Toblerone bar, the minute you see it, you know it's a Toblerone bar, now it can become a trademark. So, which you can file an application to register your trademark, which is renewable, which you can have forever. So, one of the lesser use of the legislations, which is unfortunate because it does have a really good use. So, I will go over the for now. What is infringement? Basically, it's any unlicensed, in general, used by any unlicensed party. So, somebody using your work or using your product without your permission, generally. But it's up to the owner to police it. We are responsible for the regime, the IP regime in Canada. We will grant you a patent, issue your trademark, and so on. But it's up to the owner to police it. And there are more than, you don't necessarily have to go to court right away. There's direct negotiation, mediation, arbitration, opposition. The last resort is litigation. So, funding is a valuable asset. If any of you are looking for funding, and you're sitting in front of a lending institution, they're going to ask you if your IP is in order. If you have this blank look on your face and you're not sure what they mean, you're going to say, yeah. But if you say, yes, I have kept everything confidential. What I have is proprietary. I can't disclose what it is. I can tell you what it does, but I can't tell you how it does it. So keep it confidential because they will not lend you money if you can't prove that you own what you say you own. So this is where it becomes very crucial to know about it. And you can avoid costly mistakes. It should be in your business plan. It should be at the foundation. It should grow with your business. It should be part of your strategy. So, what should you do next? There is, I left some my business cards and a little cardboard postcard on the table outside which has our website on it. You can, there's so much information available now through our website. If you click on international IP links, it will link you to all the countries around the world that have intellectual property websites. You can, there's some information on IP as related to exporting, if you're exporting, because we have now an interview with DSAIT. It's called the Step-by-Step Guide to Exporting. And if you click on number 7, there's a sample NDA, sample non-disclosure agreement there that you can go take a look, which links you to the World Intellectual Property Office. So tons of information. And you can consult an agent. That's always a good idea. So the information you see here, that's our head office. But like I said, my cards are there if you wish to contact me. Okay, good. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Stuart.
Sure, I gave you a PowerPoint presentation, but I have some notes here, and I was making some notes during Cecilia's presentation. It was a very good presentation, and a few things from that I wanted to comment on. As Shelley mentioned, I am a patent agent, a trademark agent. I do work with licensing intellectual property, intellectual property aspects of corporate transactions, but I'm also a litigator, and I litigate intellectual property issues. And through both seeing the protection side up front, the transactional side, and the litigation side, I'm aware of a lot of issues and challenges that come up with IP, some more frequently than others, and that allows me to sort of give you an overview of issues that you should be thinking about all the time whenever you're thinking about intellectual property. And my goal this morning is just to highlight some of those issues so you have them in your mind so you can potentially avoid them through the course of the intellectual property. And the way I thought I would do that is to think about intellectual property from its inception through these various stages that I talked about. They don't all happen sequentially, but you can think of them that way. And so that's where I'm going to discuss the issues. So as Cecilia mentioned, generally, the default position for ownership of intellectual property is the creator of the intellectual property. And that can be varied either by law or by contract. And so, for example, as Cecilia mentioned, in a general employment arrangement, the owner of the intellectual property will be the employer. But there's some nuances to that. So, for example, if someone comes along and say they've invented something, then the nature of their employment is important because if they were, say, for example, administrative staff and they came up with this great engineering solution, that IP may not be owned by you as the employer because it was not developed in the course of their duties. They weren't hired for the development purpose. So there's some nuances to that. So the way to cover off those potential things and remove some of that doubt is to ensure that the employment agreement that you have with all your employees states that any intellectual property that they develop under the course of their employment, and you can expand upon that within certain limits, reasonable limits, that will be owned by the employer. Associated with only one form of intellectual property, which is copyright, is the concept of moral rights. Now, this is a little bit different than the property right. It can't be bought and sold like intellectual property can. It's something that belongs to the author, and it gives them the right to be associated with the work. It gives them the right to the integrity of the work, regardless of whether they sold the work to someone else. And so what I would recommend in those sort of circumstances is make sure that they waive those rights in the employment agreement, so it avoids that issue up front. In the course of the creation, you have to be thinking about what agreements cover cover this sort of development? Are you receiving funding from anyone to do this work? What does that agreement say about ownership of IP? It should say something. Are you receiving government funding for this, either Canadian government funding or sometimes American government funding? The U.S. government in particular has strict, a very strict and complex code of ownership over IP developed under U.S. government funding. And it requires you to disclose those inventions up to the government. It requires you to elect to retain ownership. You have to specify what countries you want to retain ownership in. And if you don't do that, you lose those rights. So it's very important to be very cognizant of that. You have to be monitor that all the time. And the way that you can do that is to ensure that your employees disclose the IP that they're generating to you. You know, if you have a lab environment where someone's working on a pet project, you know, they may go a long time, oh, it's not ready yet, it's not ready, I don't want to, you know, I'm still working on it. Well, they should be disclosing that information within the company to someone so that they can know what to do with that IP. And some companies will foster innovation by, you know, giving, if you do an invention disclosure and it results in a patent, you make $1,000. So there's some motivation in there, but they do have an obligation for you. So it's good to sweeten the pot a little bit. As Cecile mentioned, ensure that your employees aren't disclosing your IP to others. And in Canada, U.S., and Korea, as you mentioned, there's a one-year period from the date of public disclosure of IP to file, of patents, rather, to file for protection. But in other parts of the country, that's an absolute bar. The way they see it is that it's no longer new. It doesn't meet that novelty requirement because it's out there. And although you were the one that disclosed it, they don't care. It's not new as compared to what you disclosed. So it's an interesting wrinkle, but that's a strict bar. So be very careful about disclosing IP. If you're going to do it under a confidentiality agreement, and I'm going to mention those a little bit down the road, just in a few minutes. A lot of people will come to me and say, if I invented something, is it patentable? Okay, sure, and so go through that exercise of searching. You should search every piece of technology disclosure, patent or otherwise, in the entire globe to find out whether it's patentable or not. Because if it becomes a commercially viable technology, someone starts infringing your patent, ripping you off for producing the same thing, you sue them for infringement, and they counterclaim and say, your patent's invalid, it never should have been issued in the first place, because I found this patent in Japan issued in 1978 that looks just like your product. And they will do that, and that's a standard technique. So you can't, but, you know, so when there's a lot of money on the line, it's worth it for them to scour and find this prior art. It may not be worth it to you up front because you have a limited budget, and I just want to file it. So there's a risk there, but you have to be aware of that risk and the benefits and the trade-offs. But anyway, my point is that there's no point in going down a development path if at the end is someone else's patent, right? Why are you spending all this R&D time and effort to find out at the end, is this patentable? No, it's not. Right? I could have told you that up front, potentially. So be very careful about where you're spending your R&D efforts. You know, large organizations will clear that path first and then say, okay, let's try and... And there was strategically, there was a hole here. Nobody's patenting here. Let's try and develop something there. So that's a lot of talk about patents. On the trademark side, just some things, again, be very careful about launching a brand, because if you launch a brand, you build up all this goodwill, you're doing advertising, you get customers, you get notoriety, you get gain market momentum and traction, and then you get this letter in the mail saying you're infringing our trademark, you know, and they may be right, and if they are, you have to rebrand. And rebranding can be extremely costly, right? It just will slow your business down. You got to tell everyone that you're now going under a new name. Right? You see this, right, in the marketplace sometimes. Now under a new name, right? Why is that? Well, sometimes they want to refresh the brand. Sometimes they've been sued and they have to do that. So who is this? Are you the same company? Are you a different company? All that goodwill is lost, right? Potentially lost. So again, searching, knowing what the IP in the area is before you go into that area is very important. Cecile mentioned trade secrets. An interesting thing, if you're doing a lot of manufacturing, trade secrets can be very important, because after they can tend to be non-reverse engineerable, if that's a word. If you can't tell how something was made at the end, that can be very valuable, right? If you say, wow, they're making this great thing, but how did they get that layer in there? I don't know. I mean, that's really tough. Why would you file a patent for that, tell them how to do it, lose those rights in 15 years, or let them start doing it, infringing your patent anyway? Because if they can't tell that you're doing it, you can't tell if they're doing it. So why are you telling them through a patent? It may be better to keep it as a trade secret. That tends to come up most in manufacturing. Cecilia talked a lot about registration, the requirements for registration, a little bit about filing strategy. Filing patents is very expensive, so you have to know where you want to protect your product, and that can be where you intend to sell a product, it can be where you intend to manufacture the product, or where you think your competitors live and where they do their work. And sometimes you do a checkerboard kind of thing. You know, you may file for protection in Germany, but not Italy, but because of the nature of your product, if you protect one, you effectively protect the other. So that's the technique that people use. So the hotbeds for patent protection are, you know, United States, also Canada in there, Japan, Germany, then you get into certain tier two, UK, France, you know, so there's a sort of priority, and depending on your market, you can make those decisions. So commercialization, just going to talk a little bit about commercialization. If you develop a product, and Cecilia mentioned, if you develop the IP, which is an improvement to existing technology, can you even make that thing that you've created? Because you only created an improvement. You don't have rights to that underlying IP. People always say, well, I've got a patent, so I've got the right to make this thing. You know, that may not be true. What you have is the right to prevent other people from making that thing. You may not have the right to do it yourself. So you may enter into licensing arrangements, cross-licensing arrangement with the people that own the related IP. Some areas can be extremely covered. They call it a patent thicket, and it really is. There's so any product. I mean, you take a modern product like your iPhone, for example. Then Apple will own some IP in there, but there's Corning owns the IP to the glass that's on the front of your phone. There's antenna technology in there. There's manufacturing technology. There's probably thousands of patents that are licensed and cross-licensed to make one device like that. So in the licensing frame, you got to think about how do you want to license this? Do you want to do it on an exclusive basis? Do you want to prevent yourself from commercializing it? What happens if the licensee doesn't really make any market traction? What can you do then? You should build into your agreement the option that they either pay you minimum royalty, so you're guaranteed something regardless of what they do, or if they fail to be effective commercializer, then their exclusive license gets converted into a non-exclusive license, so you can start finding someone else to work on the same thing. Where you want them to have the exclusivity, is it by region, is it by field of use, is it time limited, all these sorts of things that you should really be thinking about if you're going to enter into a license agreement. The important thing, I'm almost at the end here, but when you're doing any sort of transaction or licensing agreement, the licensee, the person receiving the license, or the person buying the IP, they're going to want all these protections built into their agreement saying, you guarantee me that this product does not infringe anyone else's IP. You guarantee me that you have all the rights I need to make this product. And they'll put that right in the agreement. Those are very, very dangerous things, and people ask for them all the time, and I can certainly understand why, because if I'm going to be licensing the product, I don't want to be taking the risk that I'm going to be sued. You developed this IP, you're licensing it to me, I'm going to pay you royalties. Why should I take that risk? So be very, very careful about that, because if you guarantee them that this product does not infringe anyone else's IP, and it may, that's something you can't know, firstly, because there may be a patent in Japanese that was filed 2 years ago you don't know about, and they'll sue you, right? So there's also a delay, there's a time lag with intellectual property. You file a patent application, it's 18 months before it becomes published. You don't even know what's out there. You can't know. So be very careful about that. But it's also to balance the power thing. How badly do you want to give the, do you want the license? How badly do you want those royalties? Right? You have to, you're going to have to pick your battles. So there's ways to sort of find a happy medium in there to the licensor or the vendor's actual knowledge that doesn't, you know, you can put those sort of qualifying statements in. And lastly, you have a confidentiality agreement. Anybody loves confidentiality. Hey, well, we've got an NDA, we're good. Let's get an NDA. Let's make it two-way. Let's make it unlimited. But you sign up a bunch of those, and you get into trouble because next thing you know, you've got... I used to work for a company that had thousands of NDAs, right? What information is protected? What can I say? So, I don't know. I've got to read 1,000 NDAs before I can tell you if you can disclose that information. It's very difficult. So, you want to be careful about that. Not only do you have to worry about disclosing someone else's IP, but if you have a regime under the NDA that they can just dump confidential information on you, now you're stuck with it. Like, hey, I didn't want to know that. Now, why'd you tell me that? I didn't want to know that, right? And now I have to protect it. And what if that dump of confidential information that they just dumped on you is something that is almost exactly like what you're working on in your lab, right? Now you're really stuck because they'll say, as soon as you come up with a product based on that technology, they'll say, that's from my IP. Here's the data. I emailed you all those technical specifications and documents. And you have to say, no, we were already developing it. And if you read the NDA, it says it doesn't cover stuff that we already developed independently of receiving that information. So it becomes a big mess, right? And then you get into potential litigation, and it can be very expensive. So just as a general comment, confidentiality agreements are not the best thing in the world all the time. They can be great, and they are very, very important. But just always be careful about what you're signing up to. So that's it for my comments. I just wanted to give you some things to think about, and I'm happy to take any questions on any of those or different points.
Perfect. We'll open it up to the audience for questions.
Can you tell us a bit about career and its advantage for filing out there? Because it seems to be a much more common process to file in North America, career as well.
Well, it really depends on the nature of your technology. A few years ago, everyone was like, everyone has to file in China, right? Because China was the next big emerging market. Now it's Brazil, Korea, India. So everyone's saying, let's file in Brazil, Korea, India. And so it really has to do with emerging markets, where you want to have protection. There's nothing inherently special about Korea in that respect. It's just that it's an area where people are looking. So people are saying, Brazil, energy, clean tech, you know, Brazil is really into that. Let's file down there. We have a fairly sophisticated patent system in the United States, so a lot of these major countries, some of these other countries are less sophisticated. India has a very, very antiquated patent system, so you have to keep that in mind. Korea's not bad, though. And then you have to think about what value is that patent once I get it, if it's infringed in Korea. Can I litigate that? Can I, like, a big problem with China still is that you try and litigate a patent in China, it's very difficult, and it's changed in the last 10 years or so, but even if you have the patent, some time ago, it was very difficult for you to enforce that patent in that country. So it's effectively, it can be worth less than you think it is.
I have to go to a question just for information purpose. One, if someone, let's say, was to hire an IP consultant, do you have a database or a list where we can just go and see a registered IP professional?
If you go on our website, the Canadian Intellectual Property website, there's a list of registered patent agents. They're listed by province.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Second, I was wondering whether you were aware of the litigation between RIM and another company, I don't know, for which they paid like $700 million. Can you tell me specifically what happened?
I can.
was a company called NTP, and they sued Ring for infringement, and they, I think in the United States, got an injunction at one point saying that Ring can't practice that technology, which would have effectively shut down the entire BlackBerry network, which at the time was the preeminent smartphone network. And NTP, if I recall correctly, and this is just from news media stuff that, and people here may know this better than me, but NTP was what some people call a non-practicing entity or a patent troll, or someone who buys patents from other people and then sues to people for infringement and does that on a volume basis, or goes after key players to make money on those patents. There was a company recently called i4i in Toronto that sued Microsoft for Microsoft Excel, and that was appealed. There another example of where they can sort of suck out, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars from one of these large organizations for patent infringement. So that's what NTP was, and that's what they did, and they were successful in that Rim eventually, I think what happened was Rim eventually settled the litigation, paid them on the order of $600 million, which at that time Rim just wrote a check. But I think ultimately Rim continued that litigation in some respect and found at least some of their patents invalid. So again, that concept of finding prior art to invalidate the patents that are being sued on. And so when you have a patent, just be careful. It can be invalidated after the fact.
Another question over here.
I'm just wondering about copyright and artistic works. I understand there's a lot of problems with China, Italy, places like that, in terms of them being able to reproduce a DVD or a music CD or something like that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, copyright is interesting because 15 years ago, copyright was a dead, antiquated thing about intellectual property. No one cared about copyright. It was all, you know, the book and the printing press, and it was one of the first pieces of IP to sort of exist. Now it's very hot item because of digital media, digital reproduction, and it is a big problem. It's so big that it's difficult to enforce, but ultimately it's like Cecile said, it's private enforcement, right? So companies who own the IP in those works are the ones that have to bear the legal costs to go after and shut these people down. And it can be very difficult because this isn't really infringing someone's patent, it's some guy churning out, you know, DVDs in his garage by the thousand. But they do go after them. I've done that type of work, and it does exist, but it's a big problem, and it really comes down to cost of enforcement versus the benefit of enforcement, like you say, it's a big problem. It's existing. Governments are changing laws to try and fix it, and it's just a big mess. Very unsatisfactory answer, I'm sure.
I have a question about patents. So you talk about 20 years for a patent to be enforced. Now, is that 20 years from the priority dates? Is that 20 years from the application dates, the filing dates? When does that start from?
From the filing date, from the date that the patent office receives the application, from the filing date.
So not the publication date?
No, from the date of filing.
Date of filing. Thank you.
I just have a quick question with respect to trademarks. I'm wondering, once a trademark is registered and there may be some slight adjustments made to that trademark, either be, you know, slight changes in colors or shape or size of font, that sort of thing, what are the repercussions and then what should be done as changes occur to the trademark?
The simple answer is file another registration, but that doesn't happen all the time. And so there's a lot of jurisprudence in Canada about evolving trademarks that are modernized slowly over time, and whether they can enforce those older registrations as against someone down the road, because
you know, they want to fit in Holiday Inn. They've freshened up and modernized their logos over time. And oops, you know, we're going to sue this guy for infringement. Pull up the trademark, the dusty trademark registration file. All they have is one from 1965 that looks quite different. Can they enforce that? And this is where the trademark law is very interesting, because it's very wishy-washy in the sense that a lot of it has to do with the concepts of confusion, whether a person would be confused by thinking that these words and services are associated with this person by virtue of the similar use of the similar trademark. And the same sort of concepts apply to evolving trademarks. Has the mark changed sufficiently that the consuming public would no longer associate these words and services with that older mark? And so it has to do with the degree of evolution, and we'd hire experts to say, you know, who graphic designers or do polls and surveys of people. When you see this mark, what do you think? You know, I think Holiday Inn, right? And so we'd submit that evidence. And so a lot of it has to do with how much it's changed, the degree of change, how much advertising has done to inform people of the connection, all those sorts of things. So it's very interesting from a legal perspective, but it creates a lot of uncertainty from the brand owner's perspective. So again, the simple answer is to keep filing.
But also, if it's just a word, when you're looking at a word, the best way to file is in black and white, and just in plain typing. Because when a consumer hears a trademark, they can't see font, they can't see color. So if it's the word Tylenol, I can't see if it's red or blue or if it's stylized. So and that if you file in that manner, just plain text and black and white, then you're free to use any color, any stylized writing, any font that you wish. Correct.
Well, that's right. The problem is that if they then did the Holiday Inn logo without the words Holiday Inn and called it a vacation hotel, right? If it's exactly the same logo with vacation hotel, what is the consuming public thing?
Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit bad example, but the question is, would an old consumer with an imperfect recollection of your trademark think there's an association between those products and services and you and your brand? And if the answer to that question is yes, then there's infringement. And the court will look at a number of factors: the degree of resemblance, the nature of the products and services, right? Are they, now I'm stuck in this hotel example, but, you know, are they, you know, rooms by the night, or are they sort of monthly condos? Is that a different, slightly different marketplace, right? And so all these, the degree of resemblance and the look and appearance, the sound, the ideas suggested by the trademarks, the channels of trade, all of these things are factors that the court will look to determine whether there is infringement or not. So it's a complex question to answer without specific facts, but those are the questions you should be asking yourself when you're looking at these things.
And also, Canada, we are now accepting sounds. So if you have a specific sound that identifies your brand, your product and service, you can file an application to register the sound, like the roar of the Indian lion, for example.
I have a very practical question that you must have encountered. We're here in university environments, and most of us university professors get funding from the governments, either from NSERC or from CIHR. Now, one of the basic tenets of any funding from the government is that the university or college and its researchers must retain the right to use the knowledge or IP generated for non-commercial purposes in future research and teaching. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
You've come across that before. So how does that now fit in with companies? So you have some IP, which is then licensed to a company, and the company says, no, you can't use that for teaching or research anymore.
Then you should enter into that license agreement, because you'd then be offside your agreement with NSERC or IRAP or whoever.
Okay.
And, you know, you shouldn't do that for that reason. And you should also ask the question,
question, well, why not, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people will say, well, what happens if you continue to use that IP for research and academic purposes, and then you develop something on top of that, right? I want a license to that, because I'm now marketing this product, and you're still churning away developing it, because you have this residual license, which is required by the funding agreement. And what happens if you then develop IP on top of that? Do I get that? Do I own that? Well, probably not.
Sorry, who's I?
The licensee.
The licensee.
Yeah, the licensee, the one that you've licensed the IP to, they're marketing it and you're still developing it, effectively. So what happens to that IP? And they may put in the original license agreement, they get away the first refusal to any additional IP that improves upon that technology, for example.
Yeah.
That they, or that they can automatically license will automatically extend to that stuff. It's all about, you know, the thing with licensing, it's really what the parties want. The world is your oyster. You can cut it up any way you like, subject to previously existing agreements and other rights that other people may have. So you have to know what you have to license, and then you can deal with it however you like.
So are companies generally aware that as university employees or university researchers, we have other agreements that we have to follow? Are companies generally aware of that?
It depends on the level of sophistication of the company. It depends on their previous dealings with whether they've encountered this before or not. It's some are, some aren't. It really, you know, that's it. It depends on who it is.
Now, what's the difference between licensing and assigning IP?
Well, those two concepts can converge depending on the degree of the license. So I may say, I have this IP and you can use it. I can license it to someone for a very specific purpose in a very specific geographical region. And so they only have rights to use it in very limited circumstances. That's the general nature of a license. But the more broaden those rights, worldwide, perpetual, any field of use, and it kind of looks like they own it, right? Because you've basically given over everything. So it's a continuum from a very restricted, limited license to a very broad license. And at the very end of the spectrum, of the licensing spectrum, it's akin to ownership in the sense that you may have given away every single right that you had in the license. And that kind of looks like an assignment. But you may retain rights for royalties and things like that. So that's the more nuanced answer. The basic answer is you give someone a right to do something. Assignment is that you sell it. You no longer have any rights associated with it. Goodbye. They own it. And you're done.
In the development of a formula, when there's more than one entity involved in the development of that formula, how does that get licensed on the intellectual properties?
Any sort of, people love joint ownership. They love it. Oh, okay, well, any IP we develop through this development agreement will be jointly owned and yada, 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 right? But people love to sign off on that sort of thing. But it's very problematic, right? Because, like you said, who owns what then, right? Well, it's joint ownership. But what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so what can I do? I'm joint owner. What if they try and sell their joint interest, right? Can I prevent them from selling their joint interest? Maybe not. What if they sell their joint interest to your competitor? Right? You don't want that. All of a sudden, now you co-own this IP with your competitor. It's a terrible situation. So be very careful about joint ownership. It's logistically very problematic. Who pays for the patent application? What if the patent office comes back and says, you know, claims 1 through 7 are not patentable and they're more important to the first joint owner and not so important to the second joint owner? Can you style and fight that with the patent office while the other person's rights are being held because you don't want to give up those claims? It can be very problematic. So there's lots and lots of issues that arise with joint ownership, and you should, if you can figure out a way that you're comfortable to have a situation that avoids joint ownership, I would think about it. I would think about it.
What would be an example?
Well, example is you own it and you license it to me. Right? And then, so, like, then... Yeah, well, but again, so, like, it's very fluid, right? So, if someone owns it and someone else has a license, that may be a better situation than joint ownership. And people always want to own what rights do you get from ownership above and beyond those of the licensee? And you can put any protections into that license agreement that cover you for all those things you're uncomfortable about. What if they want to sell it? Well, then say they can't sell it without your consent. What if they want to, you know, stop paying the maintenance fees and say that they have to give you the option to start paying the maintenance fees? So there's lots of ways to cover up all those things that you're concerned about and avoid some of those problems of joint ownership.
Now, you had talked about employee inventions, but what if you have contract employees or consultants? Because you always hear horror stories, you know, maybe you're developing code and the company that developed the code owns it instead of the company. So any advice?
It's a very good point. So employees, we talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Independent contractors, so if you contract someone, say you're going to be in 6 months to work on this project and we'll pay this much money, they're not strictly an employee, so you're not paying their, you know, CPP and all that sort of stuff. They're hired to do a section of work. Then under the law, they may own that IP and not the company that's contracting it to them. So that contract to do that work has to be very specific that the work that they're doing under this is owned by the company that's paying the bills. And you see, that's a common problem with development agreements is everyone wants to, well, I'm paying for this development. I want to own the IP. It's my money. Other people say, well, I'm developing it. I want to own the IP. And again, the best way to get around that is to come up with a licensing scheme that gives everyone what they want and sort of divvies it up in a way that effectively covers it off.
Especially if there's copyright involved in it too, because the author is the first owner. So it has to be captured in the contract.
That's right.
And website development is another example as well. If you hire somebody to create your website and it doesn't state in the contract that you're going to own the IP, you're just paying for the product. You're not necessarily owning your own website. So it's something.
Yeah, and you hear it all the time. Well, who owns IP? Well, I do. I pay for it. Well,
you pay for the product.
You know that, right?
Not for the product.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to this question about the inventor and the company. So in the scenario where the inventor has licensed the IP to a company and but retains an agreement where he can keep on using it for non-commercial purposes, then there's no innovation by the inventor. And you said the innovation doesn't necessarily go to the licensee, so the inventor therefore still owns it. The innovation is still based on the original IP. Can the inventor license it to someone else? Because now we're talking about the original IP and in addition to the original IP.
So you're the inventor, you license off the core technology to someone else.
And they've gone to market.
Yeah, they got money, raised money,
brought to market, have customers.
That's right. You are developing based on your academic research license that you obtained, and you come up with an improvement. And can you license that to someone else? Can you license it to a competitor, for example?
Correct.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It depends on the agreement, basically license agreement. So a good license agreement will say that they either own any improvements developed within 5 years or something like this. They get a right of first refusal to acquire a license to that
right.
IP. It depends on what the deal was up front. And so a good license agreement should cover up all those potential issues. But in the absence of some agreement, you know, that may be characterized as new IP that you developed, and you may be able to license that to someone else. But it all depends on that agreement.
So even though it might infringe on the first?
Well, that's a different question. So the question then is, when you license that to someone else, can they practice the underlying IP?
Correct.
Then that's probably no.
No,
because they don't have a license to that underlying IP, and the license that you retained was only for research and academic purposes, so even if you sub-license that's not a commercial license.
Okay.
So that may be a different question.
Okay. All right. One more question.
U.S.
So in the U.S., I don't know if it's happened yet. It's going from first to file instead of first to invent. So that poses some interesting challenges, I think. So if you're first to invent, and you're, let's say you've gone to market with a product, but you haven't filed, now someone, either by accident or on purpose, files a patent on essentially your technology, which you've already gone to market with. Now, are you infringing because you don't have the patent?
Well, there's a couple questions there. The first one is, you can only patent, you have 12 months from your date of self-disclosure to file your own patent. But say you didn't do that and say they did. The question is, did they invent that technology or did they just file a patent on someone who commercialized a product when they were seeking to protect it? Then they shouldn't be allowed to get that patent because they didn't invent it. First to file, yes, but you still have to be the inventor. Right? You can't file a patent on someone else's technology because you didn't invent it. So that you would, you know, that would go up. That would be an easy challenge.
But the audit trail sometimes is pretty tricky.
It can be tricky. But that would be a litigation, right? That patent is invalid because they didn't invent it, and you'd end up litigating that. So you're scouring through records. Show me some, witnesses. Oh, I invented it on this day, and here's the, and all that sort of stuff. Logbooks. See the point? When you're inventing something, keep a very accurate, like a research scientist will keep a very accurate logbook, what they did on what day and what the results were. Anyone inventing should do that because that's good evidence in those sorts of circumstances. Well, here's my logbook from that day, and where's your logbook?
Okay, I know there's lots of questions. Just one last question here, and then Stuart and Cecile, you stay for a few minutes behind for more questions.
Yep. I was just going to ask, I guess Stuart, either of you, one of the things in the academic world that we run into, and this is kind of connected to the consulting question as well, is an often overlooked clause, and I just wondered if you'd run into it, that asks the contractee, I guess, to waive their moral rights. And I think that this is sort of seems subtle, except in the academic world, this is really important because academics are built on, their sort of publication, that's what they do, is they publish works and so on. And I just wondered if you ran into that, and because we talk a lot in this world about IP and the rights, property rights, but and copyright. But even if you publish something, sometimes there's that clause in contracts that university research offices might see. So I wondered if you had a comment about that waiver of moral rights.
I mentioned earlier saying you should put that in your contract. But I can understand in certain circumstances where the author, the originator of the copyright, would push back. The famous moral rights case, if you've ever been to the Eden Center in Ontario, there's this, all these, it's called Eden Flight, I think, which is this large installation. And one year at Christmas, the Eden Center put little ribbons around all the geese's neck. And
Michael Snow.
Who made that work, who sold that work, sued them saying, you're infringing my moral rights because you are affecting the integrity of my work. And they never asked for a waiver of moral rights, so they had to take all the little bills off, and that was it.
Yeah.
But in a academic context, I can see why someone will push back on that. And I think a reasonable person on the other end would respect that and say, you're right, that's our standard form, and in an academic context, we can understand why you may want to retain those moral rights. One other thing you often see in development agreements with universities is a right to publish a thesis, right? So if they're employing grad students, that they have time to publish a thesis, and then they have to coordinate the filing of the patent with the publication of the thesis, and there's certain timelines built in there to cover that, because you want to have these students need to publish the thesis to get their degree. So there's those sorts of things are specific to academic situations.
Any final thoughts, Cecile Stewart?
I just wanted to mention for those of you that are professors, CIPA, our organization, we have intellectual property case studies available that are free for universities and community colleges. And you just go online and request it through our head office. And if you're not comfortable in moving to class discussion, you can actually ask for a discussion leader to come. Stuart is one of our discussion leaders, and so am I. And they're extremely, they're very good, because a presentation is one thing, but the case study engages all the students. And a lot of the scenarios that we talked about, especially the relationship between industry and all the plug research that's going on, cover these things. So go take a look on our website, and there's 8 available to choose from. So go take a look, and if you have any questions, you can definitely contact me if you need more information.
Perfect. So any other final thoughts?
That's all I got, yeah.